This is reel one of five reels interviewing Amanta Tonseth Hansen in her home in Fairbanks in the early summer of 1973, and your interviewer is Mike Dalton of Fairbanks.
And that post office box. Didn't come up then, dear.
I just want to start this out just so I make sure that we have the right volume on here.
Yeah.
So today, we'll get into some questions here, but right now I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions so I can test the volume on your voice. Today we're at the home of Amanta. Amanta. It's spelled A-M-A-T-A.
No, A-M-A-N-T-E.
E.
Did you ever have Latin?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's from the word amo.
Amo.
And it's a past participle, or one of the participles. It means worthy to be loved.
A-M-A...
N-T-E.
N-T-E. H-A-N-S-E-N.
S-O-N.
S-O-N.
Yeah, and the middle name is Tonseth. T-O-N-S-E-T-H.
And your address is...
133 4th Avenue. Fairbanks.
Fairbanks.
And that's my official voting address, too. Mm-hmm. But I never get any mail here.
Yeah.
I get my mail through the post office box.
The log house that we're sitting in here right now is the one that you're... Did your father build this house?
No. We were living in China for the first 2 years. And we lived in what is the bedroom addition here for 2 years. And then he was transferred in his work as warehouse man for Vachon and Sterling. He was moved to Fairbanks in 1909.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought this. We rented this house with the chance for buying it if we liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought it. And it's been in the family ever since.
Well, to go back to your father and your arrival in Fairbanks, could you, would you tell me when you came to Fairbanks and how you came? And you can bring your family into this, when your father came in.
Well, what about starting right when I was born?
That's a good idea. You just, why don't you just say what you
have
want to
a,
say.
Have a tape start with that, too.
Yeah.
My name is Amanta Tonseth Hansen. I was born in Portland, Oregon, on June 3, 1900. My parents were both Norwegian, and from the same general area of Trondheim, Norway, but never met until they were both in Portland, Oregon. I was their fourth child. The time around the end of the 19th century was a hard one for financially. I don't remember now just what. It was all kinds of trouble. The poor people got poorer, and I don't know if the rich got richer or anything. But my father decided that he would try his luck in the gold rush. He never was a miner, but he went up to Dawson in the fall of 1900 after I was born, and stayed one winter. Then he came out again, and in the interim of before he went north again, my oldest brother, who was named after my father, Thomas Henrik with a K, Tonseth, had died at the age of 9 in June of 1903 of spinal meningitis.
Mm-hmm.
And then my father decided, and then my younger brother was born in October of that same year, and he was named after my older brother and after my dad. So we called him Little Tom. And my big brother, when we mentioned him, why, he was Big Tom. It was Big Tom and Little Tom. They were both juniors. And I don't remember my older brother at all, because I was just three when he died. And Einar and my sister Borghild were in between us. Then in 1906, my dad decided to go north again. And this time he came to the Tanana Valley and to the town, bustling town at that time, of Chena, which is the part that we knew has been in the river a long, long time, washed in. And this new part that was way in the boondocks at that time. Then my sister died in January of 1907 of the same disease, and she was also 9. She had been 9 in January, in November of the previous year, and died in January. And she also died of spinal meningitis, which was one of the incurable diseases at that time.
Yes.
Then Dad decided that maybe it would be best in all around to send for Mother and my two brothers, Einar, who died 5 years ago, and my brother Tom, who was a retired captain of the U.S. Navy and living in Annapolis near the school at Annapolis that he graduated from in 1925. So we came up to Fairbanks, and we came on the old steamer Humboldt from Seattle to Skagway. That sunk quite a number of years ago. I don't have much recollection of the trip, but I know I was seasick.
So you were about 6?
I was 7 at the
seven,
time.
7 years old.
Yes.
You do remember being seasick,
though. I remember being seasick. And my mother, when she came from Norway, she crossed the North Sea in the roughest kind of a weather, and she was one of the few that didn't miss a meal.
Yeah.
But I'm not that kind. And then I think we came from Whitehorse to Tanana on the old steamer Selkirk, as far as I remember the folks telling. And then we came from Tanana to Chena on the old Levelian, which I saw in the spring of 1921 on the Kuskokwim River. And it was odd to see that boat that had gone around, been taken down around to St. Michael's and then around the Bering Sea to the mouth of the Kuskokwim and up the Kuskokwim River.
Now,
and
it was the Lavelle Young that Barnett came to Fairbanks in originally, was it not? Or
I think so.
Uh-huh.
It was up and down the river quite a number of years there. Then there was a Mrs. Chrysler, very prim woman that was a school teacher there at Chena. And we had to go on boards that had been laid on logs over the swamp. The town and the schoolhouse was, well, it seemed like a long ways for us, but you have a different angle of looking at things when you're small than you are when you're older.
Yes.
And they didn't have any third grade at that time, and I was supposed to be a third grader. So third grade. So they skipped me, and so I was in the. I think that was the third grade I skipped, or then it was the second grade I skipped. But anyway, I skipped a year then, excuse me. Then we, my dad was working for Vachon and Sterling as a warehouse man. And they then moved all their operations up to Fairbanks on the northwest corner of First and Lacey. And the store was there for quite a long time. He never did mine. When he went up in 1900, he was a, what we call mule skinner, although he probably drove, it was either horses or mules. He was driving horses or mules.
Teamster.
Teamster, yes, up there in Dawson. He never did mine in all the years. And he always had the idea that he wanted to go farming. It happened, though, that when he was working in the warehouse, he could go into that warehouse without turning on the lights and locate anything he wanted. One day when he was home for lunch, somebody had been into the warehouse and gotten something and left one of these carts that the, I forget what they call it, kind of trucks with the blades that they've had upright, and the blade was down, they could load it down and then tip it back and wheel it away. And somebody had left that in the warehouse, and Dad didn't know about it. And he was a great big man. And he stepped on the blade of it, and the handle, heavy oak, came up and hit him square in the mouth. We never forgot that date because it was the 11th day of the 11th month in 1911. And as a 6'2" and big bones and everything, why, he was a heavy eater. He was on the SUF diet for about 6 months before the dentist could do anything about putting new teeth in.
Oh, wow.
And that was accident. One of the things that we remembered. I never went to this school that Beth Francis was talking about yesterday down on 2nd and Noble. But the school had been operation one winter up on 8th and between 8th on 8th between Turner and Cushman when we came up, and there were houses between the schoolhouse and the street, and of course the furnace bought burned wood, and the main floor had two grades to a room, and I was in with the fourth and the fifth and sixth grade, and then the seventh and eighth grade, and then on down, no kindergarten. And then there was a stairway on each side. There was a square building, and there was two stairways going up to the upper floor. And there, at that time, they only had one great room, big room, fixed up for the high school. And later on, as I grew older and everything, I graduated from that same building.
Mm-hmm.
Then
that was the schoolhouse that preceded Main School.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that was the one that burned to the ground, luckily at night, because by that time it burned, my oldest son was in the fifth grade. And they were based in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
They were getting short of space, and the windows were rather high up because of the location. There's part underground, part above, and if those kids had been in there, every one of them would have died, and the teacher too.
Yeah.
And a lot of others, it would have practically knocked.
No way to escape.
No way to escape either.
Well, to get back to your arrival in Fairbanks, you went to Chena in 1907.
1907.
And then you moved to Fairbanks.
We arrived in Chena on the 14th of September, 1907. I'd always seen my dad with a beard. To welcome us home, he had shaved. Mother knew him, but we kids didn't know our own father. We were looking all around for a bearded man. And he had some defect that made his mouth look kind of funny, and he never shaved again, but he kept his beard very, very well trimmed at all times. Mm-hmm. He was very neat about it, not shaggy like these hippies of these of this day.
Yes.
And a well-kept beard does look nice.
Yes.
And I just can't remember seeing him after that.
Without a beard.
Without a beard.
So then you lived in Chino.
And we lived there till November of 1909 when we moved up here. And we rented the house to begin with the option to buy, which he did. And we were gradually, it was just a one-bedroom house to begin with, and with a shed tacked on the back, and a tiny basement.
So you had this big room that we have here now.
That was two rooms.
It was
two rooms.
And then the shed in the
back. And then the kitchen, and then the shed in back, and what we made into a bathroom afterwards, it was a pantry and then a shed to go, a little hallway to go out the back door. And of course, we didn't have modern plumbing at that time. We either bought the water or from the water man who came around with the horse-drawn wagons or sleds in the wintertime and the wagons in the summertime. And they had containers for it and all. Had to wash by hand with a washboard. I've done a lot of that since I was married and all, too. Then, around in, I forget just what year it was, that my dad was visiting. He had a habit of visiting people on Sundays. He was a very religious man. And he'd go and see these old-timers that were over in the hospital, which is then just one building across the river. One thing we should mention was that when we first moved to Fairbanks, there was a wooden bridge across the river with from Turner to over in front of the Sampson Hardware. That bridge would go out with a spring breakup, or then would go out in July when the high water came and the heavy rains in June and all, and bring around driftwood. It was built on piling, you see.
Yes.
And then it was a while that we'd have to go on by the ferry. The narrow gauge railroad, of course, ran from Chena to here. And then there was a spur. We'd go down as far as Estrel Creek, or, well, they call it the Estrel Creek turn thereof, and then go up Goldstream, and then it went clear up past Fox and Gilmore and over to Olness and Chattanooga, which was the end of the line. I never did ride that railroad all the way, but I have memories of the railroad, and when we'd come up from China, we would have to stop every so often at little wood piles. The wood couldn't have been more than as much as 2 feet long, I don't think, that they loaded on into the train and the car that was attached to it. And the firemen of the railroad would have to fire up with that wood until the next stop, and then we'd stop some more. Mosquitoes come in and bite us and everything in between us in the summertime. We made our first trip up for Christmas of that first year to Fairbanks. My father's sister was living up here with her family. And it was my uncle that made that chest that you were admiring here a while ago.
What was their name?
Their name was Slipperin, Jack Slipperin.
Slipperin?
Slipperin, S-L-I-P-P-E-R-N, just like
Slipperin.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just like supper with an N attached to it. And my aunt was a very tall woman also, and so was my uncle Jack, as we call him. And we'd spend, of course, not sleep there, but we would. My first recollection was stopping at the old Golden Gate Hotel, I think it was called at that time. It was just raised here a few years ago, across from the Northwood Building on the corner of 3rd and Lacey. that hotel there. Yes. And we stayed there.
It was later called the Lacey Street Hotel.
It was called Lacey Street Hotel after that. And it was quite an experience coming up and going to a hotel. And then the I recollect in the earlier days of going to the then the Eagle Hall, which was up on 5th right off Cushman, and taking in the different events there. And then...
Did you have high school dances at the Eagle Hall? Do you remember... Or did they?
They didn't have too many dances, where I can remember. But I was.
They had community dances.
Yes, they had community dances. They had those at the Eagle Hall, and then when the Moose Hall was constructed on 4th and Wickersham, between the 3rd and 4th, and between what is it?
2nd and 3rd.
2nd and 3rd on Wickersham. Why they had a lot of the events over there, and the.
And that building is still standing.
It's going to be raised soon, I understand.
I understand that they wanted to condemn it this year, but they've given it the owner 1 year extension.
Oh, they have?
Yeah. But it's now the Wickersham Apartments.
Yes.
That's the building, yes.
Uh-huh. But they used to have the big doings there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the last things that I attended there was the funeral of Dr. Delaverne. And that was quite a number of years ago.
Yes.
And that was, of course, long after I was grown up and after I was married.
But to get back to your move from Chena to Fairbanks, you came up here. This house that you still own and we're in today.
Yes.
Your father rented and then eventually bought.
Yes.
And then tell me about the addition over here.
Well,
to the east.
My brother Inger went outside in 1915 to attend the... Oregon Agricultural College at Corvallis, and he took a business course there. Before that, he had worked as a clerk in the Healy store, which was on Lower First Avenue on the other side of Cushman, and he later bought that and had it for a couple of years before he joined Lavery's staff, and then eventually got to be in the city clerk and other things. He was deputy marshal for quite a long time and all like that. But when he was gone, my dad decided that we kids were getting old enough so that we had to have our separate rooms. And on one of his trips over to the hospital, he had met an old man who had a ranch 17 miles up. He called it a ranch, 17 miles up by river from Fairbanks up the Chena, the main Chena.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the town, the river that's going past here.
Yeah.
It's not a slough, it's a Chena River.
Yeah.
And the little Chena enters into it about 14 or 15 miles up by the river.
By river.
And of course those rivers have big bends in it, so it's not so far otherwise. And Dad had come to America originally with the intention of being a farmer. He had that in his mind. So when this old man died, my dad had talked to him and that, and he assumed the man's debts and all, and relocated that homestead that the old man had, and so it was ours. And when we settled up the estate finally, after not too many years ago, why, my two brothers sold the ranch and let me keep the house and gave me full title to this, because I had taken care of Mother continually for 2 years before she died of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And where I didn't have much money, I contributed my time and energy and all.
Yes, and you were here with her.
I was here with her constantly. But from that ranch, somewhere around 1912 that he got it, and around 1913 he brought down saplings from birch trees, mm-hmm. and they are these tall birch trees that are now in my front yard. Here a few days ago, I took my little 174 camera and started taking pictures of the trees, taking them part way up, then going gauging roughly from where the bottom top of the other one was and making another one. I've got three pictures I hope eventually to put together, and I'll get them next week sometime, to make a kind of panorama of the long way, the up and down way of those trees, so I can send to my younger brother and show him how the trees have grown since he left even. But they're part of the heritage. And
you helped plant those as little
saplings. I helped plant those, and I was quite a bit smaller, of course, then than I am now.
Beautiful big trees.
And they are beautiful big trees. And I would just hate to see them cut down if they do so much of that progress, killing off the old and not supplementing with anything of beauty. They've done so much of that down on Dunkel there. They cut some beautiful birch trees down. And what good does it do to cut them down? They just ruin the place. Just like they're tearing down so many of the old places.
Yeah.
Now, this is one of the oldest places. We never had water on the floor of this house until the flood of 1967. Except what we had linoleum floors, and except when we were washing the floors. But I mean, as far as flood water, there would be flood water all around us, and there would be flood water in the basement. And that's why one thing I can't understand about this flood control, they seem to forget that water seeks its own level.
Mm-hmm.
And if the whole water level of the section is quite high, it's underground there and under where we are right now and everything else. And how can all this damming and everything else stop it? Because if it's in the when it at other times when the water has been high, and we've had it in the yard and all around the house, but never on the floor. And I was lucky enough at that time of that flood to be in Anchorage. I'd driven down there to see the two sons that I have there that are married and have families down there. My middle son is in Moses Lake. And when I came back, there had been 3.5 feet of water in the house. But in previous high waters, we had seen the water come up around the well pipe and come up into the house, the basement that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the water had never been over the floors before.
Yes.
And I lost 90% of everything I owned.
Oh.
And, of course, it was getting toward the end of the summer, and I was anxious to get headed south again because I'd been retired by that time, been retired for 4 years, and I was anxious to get south again. And I threw away a lot of things that I might have saved otherwise, but they wouldn't stand the onrush of the mold, it would mold and everything else.
Yeah.
I had to throw out all the mattresses and everything else. When I opened the door of the refrigerator that the men moved outdoors this morning for me and will take away, why, the water just poured out of it. Now, that refrigerator, they are very well sealed from the factories and all. When you shut that door, it is shut and tight. But the water was such a magnitude that it was full of water when I opened the door of that. And I had some eggs in there. That's why that was the only thing I had left running when I drove down to Anchorage. And the rains hadn't even started. No indication of rain when I drove down to Anchorage. And I was going to be gone 10 days. Then the rains came and came and came and came. And we were warned not to drive up from Anchorage. And I stayed, and then first thing you know, it was flood, flood, flood.
You didn't have anyone you could, could come in and salvage any of your...
Everybody else was busy, and if I'd been here, why, they would have picked me up and taken me some other place.
Yeah.
And I had two linoleum rugs in here with a, that were just loosely on, matching rugs. And the oil heater I had in here. And I had a great big heavy couch that was along this west wall. And when I tried to open my door, the jams had swelled so that I couldn't unlock or open the door. There were some men working down at the corner, and I went down there and asked if somebody could help me come and open my door for me. And they came and unlocked it. Luckily, I had a linoleum knife on a bookcase that was tipped over right inside of the door. I found my bookcase and everything just tipped all over. Oh. And I found this linoleum knife, and I was able, the couch had been swung right around, so it was an angle. And I had to cut my way through the linoleum in order to get into the house. And meanwhile, the refrigerator in the back room was just going full blast. The motor was going all the time. And I had a big light bill after that, too, because it had been going constantly. Yeah. Hour after hour after hour, all the time I was from the flood.
In the right in the water, the motor continued to run.
The motor continued to run. I guess the motor was higher up, though, in the thing, though. Been. But the water forced it, and I had my bookcases flopped over. I had books that I treasured, I bought, and everything for the... for my older age, and I just threw out so many, and things I didn't care about, they were kind of high up, and that's the way it happens, but I lost 90% of everything I had, including the mattress on my bed. I asked the Red Cross for a mattress replacement. That's the only thing I asked for. They came to the house after I'd finally headed south. And they said evidently, they wrote to me that evidently your house is not being used very much, so we'll deny your request. I had always given to the Red Cross, but now I would not give them another cent.
That's the only thing you asked for.
I only asked for a mattress for my bed.
This is reel two of five reels. Mike Dalton of Fairbanks interviewing Amanta Hansen in the early summer of 1973 in Fairbanks. The bedrooms that were added to this house that your father rented, then bought here at 133 4th, when were the bedrooms added to this house?
Dad already had the ranch. And instead of cutting down brand new logs and bring them down, he had the wise idea that he would tear down the old Chena cabin, which he still owned, and have it sent up on the old narrow gauge railroad to Fairbanks, and then added to the house. And that was done the winter that my brother was out in the States, so that when he came back, why, the larger bedroom was for he and my younger brother, and I had the smaller bedroom, and the folks had fixed up the back room for their bedroom. They'd opened the door from the kitchen side to this back room and fixed it up so they could have that for their bedroom. Mm-hmm.
And did you help reassemble the cabin, the logs?
Well, I was attending school and all, too, but I didn't have too much say. I had a chance to pick out my own wallpaper for it, but I was only about 15 at the time, so I wasn't too much interested otherwise, except to have a room of my own, and that is still my room.
And is that the one on the north side?
That's the northeast bedroom.
So the addition on the east side of your house here is your father's cabin from Chena.
That was a family home from Chena.
And we had it apart, brought it up here, and then reassembled it.
And for a long time, we had a door opening from the larger bedroom to the south side of the house, so that we could not have to go through the house to go out to the outdoor privy.
Yes.
And things have just been gradually added to it. A lot of these things I have done myself to fix up this house.
Well, the cabin that your father had in Chena, did he build it in Chena?
No, he bought it. He bought it. No, so, he was working. He couldn't.
So if he went to Chena then in 19...
He went to Chena in 1906.
So the...
We lived in another house the first month or so we were in Chena, and then we moved into this other one, which he later bought, just like he did this one.
It's safe to assume then that the addition to this house that came up from Chena was one of the first houses in Chena.
It was one of the early houses.
Chena started when, in 1902?
Chena was started around in 1902. No, I don't think this house was that. I don't think that addition was that old. It was one of the newer houses when we got to Chena. I think it was probably built around in 1905 or 6. Mm-hmm. And as near as we could trace back this main part that we're right in now, why that was built summers around that same time. But it must have been built in the. After the big fire of 1906, which was in the spring of 1906 before my dad came up from the States.
Do you remember who owned this house?
I have
when
no...
When your father bought it?
I have no idea who... The deeds... I forget just where the deeds are now, whether they're... I might have them down there. They
in
are
Phoenix.
In Phoenix in my safe deposit box there. Or I might have turned them over to my oldest son to keep for me. I've given up my own safe deposit box here because I was having less and less in it, and I've got more and more things down there.
Mm-hmm. I hope that this house won't be razed by the city or condemned, and I hope it can be preserved for historical value. Because
The assessors and that have been kind to me. They have come and seen the house, how it is. And I know every square inch of the place because I've done something or other to every single square inch of it. And I paid for it. Like I paid to have the aluminum roofing put on here. That was after I was divorced and was on my own. So my husband had nothing to do with the ownership of this house. The estate was settled after my divorce. And that was 25 years ago.
You were divorced 25 years ago.
25 years ago
but
last
after
January.
After you left high school, you've remained living in this house all of your life?
I wasn't living in it. But I've never... I've always had something in it. Mm-hmm. Because even when I've been away, I've always left something at home. Mm-hmm. And either clothing or books or something, there was always something of mine in the house. And so that in one part or the other, it's always been something.
When you were married, when you got out of high school then, did you work in Fairbanks or were you married shortly afterwards?
No, I graduated 55 years ago last spring from Fairbanks High School and from the old wooden school that I'd been attending. Margaret Harris, or Margaret Keenan as she was then, was the principal at the time. She was a very staid woman. Very well educated and everything, but I can't remember that she cracked very many smiles. And she later married Martin Harris, who was one of the influential men in the territory when we came here in 1907, and was for a long time. They married and lived in Valdez for quite a number of years. But if you look into the back records, well, you'll find that Martin Harris was one of the men that was influential in making a lot of the laws and everything else. Mm-hmm. And later years, we had, when I was in high school there, Margaret Keenan insisted on we have assemblies of the whole entire school. Every so often. And then we would have it in the big high school room where a study hall. And but she was very prompt about and stayed about everything. And it was if we were not in our seats when the bell rang, we were considered tardy. We could be in the room and not in our seats, and we'd be considered tardy. And it was one day that Alton Nordale, who was one of my classmates, and who was nicknamed Tubby, rightly, because he was quite heavy, fat, and he was later killed in a crash of a small plane when he was coming from Dawson.
Is that the plane that disappeared and no trace has ever been found?
No, they found it after a number of years. They found it, and they could recognize Alton's location because he had been wearing, in later years before that accident, he had to wear a special brace for his back. And they could pick out his location in the plane from the steel that didn't burn of the brace. And somebody gave me a photo of that plane. It was just the framework that didn't burn, you know, the steel parts. And I gave it to his daughter, Mary, a number of years ago while she was still with the DA's office in the old federal building. And then she turned it over to her mother. Mm-hmm. I saw her mother and Mary at the...
at the mug-up, weren't they?
No, I saw them at the Traveler's Inn the other day when the Monday, when the few pioneer women that were left, Mrs. Rust and who had her sister as guest, and Mildred Nerland and Dorothy Loftus and myself and Adrienne Coyle were there having a dinner together.
Mary Nordale's mother is Catherine Nordale.
Catherine Driscoll Nordale. And she was a teacher here in the schools mm-hmm. when she met Alton. And they were married, and they had Mary and Jimmy before Alton was killed. Mm-hmm. And Catherine has been, I don't know if she still is or not, when I talked to her the other day, I didn't ask her if she was still working.
I think she's retired now.
But she was postmaster at Juneau for quite a number of years. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy has moved to Fairbanks now, so they are living here.
Yes, he's the attorney now for the North Star Borough.
Oh, is that what he
is? And Mary is an attorney also, as you know.
Yes, I know she is.
Associated with Barry Jackson.
Oh, is that it?
Mm-hmm. In his firm.
I saw Mary I'd given her this print, and then she turned over to her mother. And then I hadn't seen her then for a number of years till I saw her the other night, mm-hmm. and they happened to be passing through the Travelers where we were sitting at this table, mm-hmm. and Catherine stopped to talk to us, and then I got to talk to Mary for a moment or two also.
How did we get on the subject of Alton Nordale? Oh, you were going to the assembly.
One time there that the bell started ringing and Alton was trying to get to his seat fast enough. And when he sat down on the seat, it busted. He sat down so hard. He was heavy anyway. And it busted. And we all laughed. And Miss Keenan, as she was then, happened to be in the room at the time. The teachers that were also there, Miss Myrick, whom we all loved, she was there too, and she couldn't help cracking a smile and all. Miss Keenan came with her arms crossed and very, very severe. She didn't have much to say then. But on dismissal bell, she came in there just before dismissal bell. You will remain seated. And she lectured us for, I think it must have been 3/4 of an hour, on the impropriety of laughing when somebody's accident like that. And it was something that Alton even enjoyed, you know, because you can laugh at yourself when you have something funny happen. And he wasn't hurt or anything. It just happened, the seat broke, and it had to be fixed before he could use the place again. But it was just humorous at the time. one of the last years that I was in high school, that we could see mirages on the mountains south of Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And the ever-changing, it was just the air conditions. And we could watch the changing if we had a chance to get to the windows when the teachers weren't watching us. After graduation, you asked me after graduation, I had a chance to go out the 18-mile roadhouse to tutor three children of the widowed owner of the 18-mile roadhouse. This was in the fall of 1918. Mm-hmm. Ann Sheldon was the oldest of them, and then she had a half-brother and half-sister. And I especially stressed the teaching of Ann because she had missed a couple of years schooling in here, in town here. And so that she, I put her through the seventh grade and half the eighth grade so that she could take an examination when she came into town in January to enter the, and entered the eighth grade with the rest of her class. Mm-hmm. And
that's Bobby Sheldon.
Bobby
wife.
Sheldon's wife.
What and was Francis, her name?
It was she was Ann Bergman at that
Ann
time.
Bergman.
Ann Bergman, and I had known her then for several years. She has been very ill in Seattle now the last number of years, and when I saw her last fall, I thought sure it would be for the last time. But I understand she's still.
Yes, but she's
Hang
very,
on.
Very ill.
She's very, very ill yet, and has been for such a long time. Bobby is 17 years older than I. We happen to have the same birthdays.
Is that
And
right?
He is taking care of her.
Yeah. Their daughter, Mrs. Erickson.
Yes.
Frances Erickson had a birthday party for Bobby.
Yes, I know that.
Down in the Claremont Hotel.
Yes, and I always stay at the Claremont when I'm in Seattle, too. And I see them there.
Oh, do you expect to see them on this trip?
I will be stopping at the Claremont for about a week. I have had examinations at the Mason Clinics since 1958. And the first examination, I had been going to a doctor here in town, and he had been treating me for colitis. And I was going out for the Rebecca Assembly, which was to meet at Yakima that year in June. And I was cooking at the jail at the time, at the federal jail. And my vacation would have to start on a Sunday morning and end on a Saturday night. I wasn't doing Yakima before on a Saturday morning. So Eva Larson, Mrs. Roy Larson, as a registered nurse, she talked me into seeing her doctor and having a real good physical in
Seattle,
Seattle at the Mason Clinic. And so I wrote for an appointment and had one, and he gave me the most thorough examination that I've ever had in my life and found that I had a tumor on the intestine. He turned me over to a, he's just an MD, you see,
yes.
Not surgeon. He turned me over to Dr. Lucius Hill as a surgeon, as Dr. Cleveland had. And Dr. Cleveland gave me pre-operative instructions and all, and let me go to Yakima and then spend a weekend with my son and his family at Moses Lake, my second son. And then to enter the hospital at the on the 1st of July.
See, our
that was in 58. The assembly always meets the last full week of June. That is the assembly of Washington and Alaska. We were under the jurisdiction of the with them.
Yes.
And so I entered the hospital. The hospital on the 1st of July, and they couldn't get the operating room before the 3rd, and they did the surgery on me on the 3rd. Then, of course, it was the 4th of July holiday and all, and the following Monday, which was the 8th, my doctor, my surgeon, came in to my room early in the morning with his interns, who usually went ahead and reported to him, and then he'd check on it, you see. And he told me, he said, Mrs. Hansen, he says, you are one of the most fortunate of women. The tumor I removed, according to the lab report, was full of malignant cancers that would have been rampant within a month and would have caused strangulation in the bowel within 6 months and caused death. He says, you are one of the most fortunate of women. My mother had died, my father died of cancer of the liver and gallbladder in 1929. His doctor told him that he better go outside for more surgical aid, and it was too far gone, the cancers, by the time the doctors there just opened them up and sewed them right back up. And then mother had cancer of the breast 3 years later, and I prayed to God that he would let her come back. She had that surgery in Seattle, and God let her come back, but this cancers had already spread.
Yeah.
And for 2 years, I took care of mother right here in the house, watching her die by inches.
Yeah.
And of course, being later in jail work, why I use the expression, it just seemed like my hands were handcuffed behind my back.
Yes.
Because of the, was no matter what I did for her, I gave her the morphine at stipulated times and all, and which I had to count for every single one that
oh,
I,
of course.
And it had, couldn't be, the doctor said I could take care of her better here, and she'd be more content in her own home.
In her own home.
And she died in that larger bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
My youngest son had been taken care of by, and taken out the creeks by some friends, and he was staying with them, and he'd been brought back the morning that after she died. But she died in that room.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had prayed God would let her come back to me. Since then, I've learned to pray, Thy will be done,
mm-hmm.
and help me to be prepared for anything that does come, but always Thy will be done. It's a hard way to learn, but it'll be 39 years Monday since she died, and I helped lift her in the coffin. She died on the intake of the breath, and when Hosie Ross came to get, I phoned for Hosie to come right away so as to get her out of the house before the youngsters woke up. And when I helped lift her into the basket, why the breath was expelled. She had died on the intake of the breath.
Mm-hmm.
And but she was very, very dead by that time.
Oh, of course.
And she's over here in the Masonic plot.
And
but
she
was
sick for about 2 years.
It was over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I had a dread of cancer, and I always vowed that if I ever had cancer, I'd take my own life rather than have my sons or anybody go through what I had gone through those 2 years. Because it was agony, and I didn't have much money to go on or anything at
and
the
you
time.
Were,
and my husband was I wasn't a widow.
Oh,
no, I was up here, and my husband was harping about it and everything else, and we hadn't been getting along then for a long time, but it finally ended in divorce. I shouldn't have married him in the first place, because he's one of these men that are very nice to other people, but oh boy, he thinks wife is supposed to be the slave of the man. And I hadn't known that when I married him. I thought he was would be considerate to me, like my dad was to my mother. And they were just very, very happy to the very last.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know I had cancer before, after the cancer had been removed and I was cured of it. The next year, I went down on my vacation. And meanwhile, I had bought my first car, a Simca. To celebrate by being free of cancer. And I left here earlier than I should on the way to Seattle and another checkup, and wrecked the car on the way. I hit loose gravel, and first thing you know, the car rolled clear over. It was in Canada. And I had a broken ankle from that. right ankle, and then I was put on, I was on crutches when I got back down to Seattle and had my checkup. And the doctors then, the surgeon himself made the procto examination, and he found I had a little tiny cancer in the rectum. They thought they'd had to do a colostomy on me the year before, but I escaped that. But this year, in 59, they had to do a permanent colostomy. You never go back to the other way. Mm-hmm. And it was successful. I haven't had cancer since. And it'll be 14 years now, the 26th of August, since I had that surgery. I've had checkups every year for cancer, and no cancer since.
And you can thank Eva Larson for
I credit her on saving my life, because if I hadn't had that checkup, I never went back to the doctor that was treating me for colitis. I speak to him on the street and say hello to him, and he calls me by my first name. I call him by his first name, mm-hmm. but I've never gone back to him as a physician or anything since.
But then in Fairbanks, you don't have the specialists. I know I have went to the Mason Clinic one time mm-hmm. after I had been ill up here and had a physical, and they just didn't have the facilities to do every check that should have been done. And I went out there and they found out what was wrong and took care of it. But they have marvelous facilities.
They have, and it's been improved so much since I started going there.
They improved quite a bit here, too.
Oh, they have.
Since those days. And when you go in for a physical, I know 15, 20 years ago, you go in for a physical here. Sometimes the doctor would thump you on the chest and listen to your heart, take your blood pressure, and look in your eyes and nose and mouth, and that was about it.
Yeah.
And there's so many parts of your body that there's no way to detect the condition of the body,
there's
the interior organs.
2 years ago this spring, I had gone to... Well, this gets way away from the Alaska part, but I had gone to a doctor in Phoenix, not too far from my apartment, and he was kind of plump for a doctor, and a doctor is usually telling you to trim down and everything.
Yes.
Oh, you must reduce. And yet this doctor had a pot belly on him, and he was under 40. And he said something about that I was diabetic, but he didn't follow it up or tell me what to do. And somehow or other, I didn't like his receptionist either, so I just quit going to him. I didn't have any friend appointments with him. And then that fall, when I passed through, when I come north from Phoenix, that's where I've been spending my winters the last number of years since I retired in 63, I come, just change planes at SeaTac and come on up. Then when I go south again, I take my time and stop off in Seattle a week, maybe 2 weeks, or more, maybe longer, depending upon my physical examinations and everything. And I've been having examinations there all the time. And my doctor, Dr. Cleveland, then 2 years ago, he found that I was diabetic. I told him what this other doctor said, and sure enough, the test showed that. He had discharged me as far as... and put me on special medications and all like that. And then I wasn't going to South before the next week. I was going to spend Labor Day there in Seattle and that. And on Monday, Saturday and Sunday and Monday, I wasn't feeling good at all. A friend came over to see me on Tuesday, and she said, "You better see Dr. Cleveland again." And so I phoned for him and asked him if he could squeeze me in, and she went with me. Luckily, I took my colostomy things with me. And when he checked me, he said, "You better go over to the hospital." And he kept me there for 4 days, putting me on more medicine to adjust me to being a diabetic. And then I learned a lot more about diabetes and all.
I'll bet you did, quickly.
And then last summer... I came up. I had been up to Anchorage the 25th of from the 25th to in February of 25th of January to attend the wedding of a grandson in Anchorage, and gone back out and had another checkup. That was just a few months then after he'd checked me for diabetes, and he said I was getting along fine. He checked my blood sugar and that, and then last summer I had come up especially for Golden Days. because my oldest son, whom he met, and his wife were King and Queen Regents of the Anchorage Pioneers. Yes. And I knew Earl Beeslein well enough, he's always the master of ceremonies out there at the Pedro, that to know that that if I were there, why, he would let me introduce Bob and his wife to those present. So I was looking forward to that. Instead of that, the morning of the 22nd, which was on a Friday, and the tea was that afternoon and that, I hadn't been well at all that night for several days before and couldn't keep anything in my stomach or anything else. And just too lethargic to even phone for the doctor or anything. I knew Jim Lundquist, about the only doctor I knew in town here anymore, because the doctor I had been going to after my cancer surgery was Dr. Tatum, and he was no longer here. Mm-hmm. And he had joined when I started going to Dr. Tatum, he was with the Fairbanks Clinic. And then he told me one day, he says, well, this will be the last day I can treat you. He says, I'm going away. And I said, where are you going? Oh, he says, it just happened to say, where are you going? And he says, are you quitting Alaska or what? And he says, no. He says, I'm going up to the Tenino Valley Clinic to go with Jim Lundquist and the rest of them. I said, look here. I said, you are my doctor, not the clinic. I said, you make me an appointment there. So I kept on going to Dr. Tatum. Mm-hmm. And then I just learned last summer that from Jim Lundquist that Dr. Tatum had died. Mm-hmm. And he had moved down there. And when I talked to my best friend there in Seattle, the one whose picture I showed you here a while ago, the enlargement, she told me that she had heard that that Dr. Carter, who used to be up here, had just died recently in Seattle.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. And I came up on the 2nd. I talked to her on the phone from the airport there on the 2nd of June. Mm-hmm. So he must have died the last part of May or the early part of June. And he'd been my doctor for quite a number of years.
But to get back to last year, you didn't get to the Pedro Monument dedication?
I didn't.
You were so ill?
My granddaughter and her family, she's got three little tykes, and you ought to hear them call me great-grandmother. they drove up from Anchorage. Her husband works for my oldest son, and she's my oldest grandchild. And they drove up here in their van thing, and she knocked at the door, and it was all I could do to come here and open the door for her and pop down on that thing there. And she said, Grandma, she says, you're sick. She says, who's your doctor? And the littlest fella came in, and he wanted to kiss his great-grandmother, and I was just too sick, and he cried. It was kind of pitiful. But then she phoned and got an appointment with Dr. Lundquist, who had helped with the surgery on me way back in 1951. Mm-hmm. That was a long time before the cancer area. And so I knew Jim, but when he was started up for himself, after my doings down there in Seattle and found out I had cancer, he had started his clinic on the other side of the river. That was before he started it up on Noble.
Yes.
And that was just a little too far for me to walk after working hours. I was still working for the Federal at that time. That is when he started over there. And he was the only doctor I really knew in town here then, so she got an appointment, and he said, you're really sick enough to go to the hospital. Well, I held out till Bob and Ginny came up from Anchorage later that day, mm-hmm. and instead of my going to anything, they took me over to the Memorial Hospital, and I hope the building is warmer than it was, because I was just cold all the time I was there, and I was there for 4 days. I didn't even have a TV to watch the parade or anything else. But I bought myself a new 110 camera for my birthday that year.